Yes, thank you for coming to such a provocatively entitled talk. I want to slightly apologise for the rudeness of the title. And I want to say at the outset that I hope this won't be a kind of contest of intellect or a kind of battle. When I was an atheist, I used to occasionally go along to this kind of talk, and I went, at least at first, out of a kind of intellectual sport. You know, I thought, I'll pick a fight with the speaker, and if I'm cleverer than him, then I win and he loses, etc. I want to say I'm not hoping to set this up as a cleverness contest, and I would hate for you to assess the viability of following Jesus based on how clever I sound today. There'll be people here much cleverer than I am, and I'm not trying to just win arguments. In fact, I remember the vicar of the church where I became a Christian in Cambridge. I remember him saying that he never remembered losing an argument about Christianity as a non-Christian. And if you ever knew him, you'd have understood why. He was a formidable debater. He said, as a non-Christian, I always won. It's very easy to win an argument if you don't care about truth. You just move the goalposts until you win. He said, the one thing I couldn't understand about Christians was why, having lost the argument, they came back the next day maintaining exactly the same position. And I knew, as an experienced arguer, that was one thing you never did. But these Christians would be knocked down again and again and again. And that's what made me realize they must have something other than just the desire to argue that kept them believing it all. And I want to say at the beginning, my desire is not to argue, and I don't promise to win. If you want to take me on, you might well have a cleverer argument than I have. But the question today isn't what's cleverest or which scores most points, but what is true. What is true about the world we live in? What is true about the God who may or may not be there? And I want to share at least some of my own path of discovery about how I came to believe in Jesus and came to believe that that was scientifically a responsible thing to do. But as Marcus said, I didn't always used to be a Christian. And as I began at university in my first year at Cambridge studying natural sciences, I was an atheist. And quite an arrogant atheist, sadly. Like many Cambridge students, I was pretty full of myself. And I wrote a poem to express my contempt for Christianity. Now, you ought to understand that I wasn't an English student, and so my poem is limited in its kind of literary merit. But I can still remember it, and it goes like this. Some folks seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in wishing wells. There we are, that's it. That's my profound literary contribution. But in some ways, there's something of my contempt for Christianity. I thought it must be that people were superstitious. Yeah, it's just like throwing money into a pond and making a wish and hoping that tomorrow will turn out differently as a result. It must be that people don't understand the basics of science. They mustn't have realised that we know about cell biology now. I mean, sure, people used to believe in God. People used to think that God made it rain. And then we came to understand the water cycle, which you did in geography. And then we understood that was why it rains. And people used to think God made people ill. And then we found out about bacteria, and that's why people get ill. People used to think that God created life. And then we found out about DNA and cell division, and that's how you get life. And surely it must be that Christians just don't understand those things. And science is against them. Richard Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, he makes a similar point. He says that belief in God is like belief in the tooth fairy. Something that's okay when you're kind of 8 or 9 years old, but it gets embarrassing when you're a teenager and needs to be put behind you by the time you're an adult. Science and Christianity. I used to think that Christianity was unscientific and naive. But quite soon after writing that poem, everything changed. I met some Christians at college with me, and at first I was very intrigued and attracted by the lives that they lived as Christians. They told me that they knew the God who'd made them, and it almost seemed as if they did from the way that they behaved and conducted themselves. Now, it wasn't that I thought it must be true just because it had this wonderful effect on people's lives, but it did make me curious, and I wanted to find out more about it. And I began to look into some of the evidence, and to cut a long story short, I became a Christian. But I still carried on with my science degree. I still managed to study science as a Christian. And in fact, it became a very exciting area of study. As Marcus said, I did my PhD on the ear, which sounds glamorous, but what it actually meant was I spent 3 years of my life in a soundproof room listening to about 20,000 clicks and trying to work out where they came from. I think not where they came from, kind of existentially. I mean, where in space they came from. But as I looked into them, the mechanisms, just the one little area of science I know something about, the processing in the brain of sound is absolutely phenomenal and faster than any modern computer. The brain is able to do things with sound that even a massive computer cannot do. And to understand that about the human body and to see it as part of the design of a wonderful God who made it, it's a great joy as a Christian. It's all no conflict particularly per se. And in fact, there were many much greater scientists than me in the university who were also Christians. So I started going to a church in Cambridge, and I met there the professor of geophysics from Cambridge University, who was a committed member of the church council at the time. I met one of my biochemistry lecturers in the church, obviously scientists and at the same time Christians. And in fact, if you go back in history, that's the pattern that you often find. Many of the first scientists were committed Christians. In fact, arguably, according to one historian of science, science came about because of the prevailing view of the world that God had designed it. Listen to the words of Sir Alfred North Whitehead, the historian of science. He said, "Man became scientific because he expected to find law in nature. And he expected to find law in nature because he believed in a lawgiver. It was because people thought that God had put the world together in an ordered and intricate way that they wanted to find out how the world worked in the first place. If we had believed about the world, as some do now, that it's entirely chaotic and random and by chance, why bother investigating it? Why expect order out of a universe that's random?" But they thought that God had made it, and that's why they began to be scientific. So people like this, you might know some of these names. Isaac Newton, obviously, he formulated the theory of gravitation. Michael Faraday, who discovered electricity. Charles Babbage, who made the first mechanical computer. Louis Pasteur, who discovered the microbe. James Clerk Maxwell, who did work on interplanetary motions. Robert Boyle, who came up with those annoying Boyle's laws that if you did A-level chemistry, you had to learn. All of them scientists, and all of them committed followers of Jesus Christ. You might say, well, yeah, that was a long time ago. Obviously, we've learnt a lot more about science since the 18th century. But actually, even today, some of the most eminent scientists at the same time, Christians. So the very same year that Richard Dawkins published his book, The God Delusion, Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project, the project to sequence the human DNA, he published his book, The Language of God, in which he articulates his belief in the Christian view of God. So it certainly doesn't seem to be a simple case of as soon as you're a scientist, as soon as you understand science, you can't be a Christian. Doesn't seem to be as obvious as that. Certainly many great exceptions in the past and the present to that. But undeniably, there is a conflict going on. You just can't miss that and live in London. You can't miss that if you read this, The God Delusion. It was the number one bestseller, non-fiction, for months and months. You'll have heard Dawkins on the radio. You'll have seen the bus campaign. I hated bendy buses anyway, being a cyclist, but then you see those slogans on the side, there's probably no God. Actually, I think that did Christians a favour, because, you know, the word probably, people think, oh, but what if there is? And people started flooding to church. So thanks, Dawkins, for the end goal. But you can't help but have seen the conflict. You might have seen the press recently. In the Times, it was serialised, or on the radio, about Stephen Hawking's new book. I think this is the most expensive book per page I've ever bought. It was 19 quid, which is the tiny thing. You might have seen the publicity about that. They're all around us. There are scientists who are also atheists saying you can't believe in Jesus if you're going to be intellectually responsible. But I want to suggest this evening that the real conflict isn't between science and faith in Jesus Christ. I want to suggest that's not really where the conflict lies. Rather, the conflict is between two different worldviews, two different philosophies, two different ways of looking at the world. If I was going to be provocative, I'd say between two different faiths. Because that is one of the ironies of Dawkins' writing and others like him. If you read through the book, if maybe you have read through the book, The God Delusion, the number of times that he says in the book, I believe, and then makes an assertion without giving any empirical evidence to support it. In some ways, it's a very faith-filled book. Dawkins has a framework of his thinking, which is atheistic, and certainly does conflict with the teaching of the Bible. But I want to suggest that science isn't automatically on his side. Science is a system of inquiry for observing the world and testing theories about the world. There's nothing inherent to science which favours atheism per se. Atheism is a philosophy, Christianity is another one, which is right. Now, of course, you can set things up slightly unfairly, and some people want to do this. They want to set science up atheistically. So the only kind of results that you accept as being scientific are ones that presuppose an atheistic view of the world. But all you've done then is bias the experiment before you start. Imagine if I were to make a machine for detecting light. In fact, I made a machine to detect only visible light. So it's got a prism inside. It breaks light down into all its constituent wavelengths from blue all the way through to red. But it's only got detectors as far as the visible spectrum. There's nothing off the edge of blue and red inside, if that means anything to you. So anyway, I make this machine, and you say to me, Andrew, I think I've discovered this thing called infrared light. I think that's how the remote control on the television works. I say, oh, really? Let me test it with my visible light detector. And say, I set up my machine, and you press your button, and I say, it's registering nothing on the needle. No, infrared light doesn't exist. That'd be very bad science, wouldn't it? If I've set up the experiment only to be sensitive to visible light, I cannot use the experiment to say anything about the existence or otherwise of something it wasn't designed to test. If I set up science naturalistically, so that the only kind of explanations I accept as being scientific are ones which presuppose atheism, I can't then use that system of inquiry to prove atheism. I smuggle it at the beginning, so obviously I get it out as a result. That is not a very scientifically sound method. There are these two worldviews, and what I want to do in the rest of the talk is to outline them for you, and then ask the question, which one makes most sense of the evidence, which I think would be the scientifically responsible thing to do. So here are the two views. The first one is called naturalism, or atheism, and that is the philosophy that matter and chance are all that there is. All that the world is just matter and chance. So actually, if you follow Stephen Hawking, all that there is in the very, very beginning is the law of gravity, and from that everything else came. Carl Sagan, the cosmologist, he's done his TV program about this. He once said, parodying the Bible statement that God was and is to come, Carl Sagan said that the cosmos was and is to come. All there's ever been is the cosmos. Or Bertrand Russell, the great British philosopher, he once said that mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. Or Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, every living being was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Not a cheery guy to have around, I guess, but that is naturalism. Everything is reducible to matter and chance, the law of gravity. And that is in conflict with the view of the Bible and the view of Jesus Christ. And I want to just read you a little bit of the Bible to give you the Bible's version of the world. I don't want just to give you my version of Christianity. I thought I'd give it straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. This is from one of Jesus' followers when he gives a speech in Athens, which was the kind of first century intellectual capital. It's like the first century Harvard or somewhere like that. And we're told he got talking to some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. I don't know much about Epicureanism. I looked up in a dictionary of philosophy, and apparently the Epicureans believed that the gods were so remote as to really play no involvement in human affairs. Things were basically down to random chance, and there was no survival after death. So in some ways, they're a little bit like today's naturalists or atheists, and this is what one of Jesus' followers says to them in the Bible. Let me read it to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all humankind life and breath and everything. And from one man he made every nation of humankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place.
in order that they should seek God in the hope they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he's actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he's fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he's appointed. And of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some of them mocked, but others said, we will hear you again about this. Maybe that will be some of the reactions here this evening. So that's the Christian worldview. And I wonder if you can see right at the beginning, it's almost the exact opposite of the atheistic one. See, both religion, both faith position has to account for the phenomenon of religion in the world, belief in God. But according to the atheist, God is something that we have made. Humans have come up with this idea of the divine. According to Paul in the Bible, mankind is something that God has made. God came up with this idea of humanity. Almost exactly the opposite view of the world. And the question is, which one of them makes most sense? I'm going to compare them in three ways. We've got about 10 minutes left of me. I'm going to compare them in three different ways. Firstly, which one makes most sense of the scientific existence of this world as it is? Secondly, which one makes most sense of human life? Thirdly, which one makes most sense of Jesus Christ? So firstly, which one makes most sense of the world as we see it scientifically? In particular, which one makes most sense of design in the world? Now, that is a very controversial word to use, but everyone agrees that the world looks as though it was designed. So Fred Hoyle, the astronomer, once said famously that the idea of randomness coming up with the kind of world that we live in, with a floating church in a Canary Wharf development, is a bit like saying that a whirlwind passed through a junkyard and came up with a 747. It just doesn't seem to be very random. Looks purposeful and designed. But according to atheists or naturalists like Richard Dawkins, design is just a trick that the universe has played on us, just an illusion. This is what Dawkins says in his book, his earlier book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was on the compulsory reading list for me when I started university. He says this, design, he puts it in inverted commas to show his contempt for the idea, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it, natural selection. The blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of an apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker. Looks designed, it's just an illusion, it's actually just random. But the Bible says, no, the God who made the world and everything in it, he himself gives to all men life and breath and everything. It's exactly the way that he ordered it to be. Which one makes most sense? Let's take the Big Bang theory. Most scientists agree on that. According to the view of inflation, the very beginning of the universe, the expansion rate of the universe in the very first few seconds has got to be exactly correct. If the universe expanded too quickly at the Big Bang, all you would have is hydrogen atoms, each one separated by millions of miles of vacuum. Just very spread out gas, that's all you'd have. Nothing any bigger than hydrogen, no planets, no humans, nothing like that, just gas. On the other hand, if the universe expanded too slowly, then gravity would get the better of it, and you get a Big Bang, and then it would collapse in gravity in a big crunch, even before you got to 1 second on your stopwatch. Universe, no universe, all over. To have any kind of universe like the one that we live in, which lasts for longer than a second and has stuff bigger than gas in it, the expansion rate has got to be exactly right to within one part in 10 to the 70. One in with 10 to the 70 noughts in the end. And if you can't get your head around that number, just imagine covering the Earth with 5 penny pieces, stacking them to a depth of the distance between here and the moon. Yes, I know there's not enough metal in the world to do that, but if you could make that many 5 penny pieces, paint one of them red, blindfold your boyfriend or your girlfriend, get him or her to pick one at random, gets the red one, 1 in 10 to the 70. And the atheist has to say, just lucky, just chance. And the Christian says, no, we need a principled explanation for this. God designed it. Now, actually, the atheist doesn't quite say that now. So Stephen Hawking's great contribution in the grand design is this thing called M theory. He says that actually there must be, these numbers are so unlikely, there must be a multiverse of infinitely many universes. And so because there are infinitely many of them, one of them was bound to get lucky with the right numbers. You know, if you throw the dice a million, billion, billion, billion times, eventually you're going to get the secret combination you want. And yet this is what the review of Stephen Hawking says in the journal Nature, the preeminent scientific journal, which a friend pointed out to me. He says this: the multiverse is possibly the most important idea of our time, and it may even be true, but it gives me a headache. Is it science if we can't test it? Of course, it isn't science, by definition. There's nothing you can do as an experiment in this world to prove the existence of infinitely many other worlds. It's actually just a statement of faith. Because everyone must now concede that this world looks vanishingly improbable. The numbers are so finely tuned, it cannot have just been an accident. And so a Christian will say there's a God who made it, and an atheist will say a multiverse. But by blind faith, a multiverse. The question is which one makes most sense of the evidence. I think multiverses are problematic for all kinds of other reasons, and you're welcome to ask about that if you want to in question time. But secondly, which one makes most sense of human life? Now, I'm going to give an argument now, which I think doesn't actually argue for either view being true. I think it just does expose how unlivable naturalism is. Let me say that again. I don't think it means that Christianity must be true, but I think it does expose naturalism as being unlivable. And the reason I think that's important is I was a very comfortable atheist. So I used to give Christians a hard time all the time, but I never bothered to examine my own position and the ground on which I was standing. And I want to suggest it is a problematic position to stand on. Here, this is John Gray. He's a professor of European thought at the LSE. Apparently Tony Blair's favourite philosopher. I don't know if that makes you him appeal to you or the opposite. This is what he says. He's basically arguing that naturalists fail to follow their position through to its logical conclusion. And he says that they should. Mankind must accept that his or her existence is entirely accidental. He must realise that, like a gypsy, he lives on the boundary of an alien world, a world that is deaf to his music and as indifferent to his hopes as it is to his suffering and his crimes. It's very telling, that phrase. If the world is random, you believe that it is sincerely, you must accept that everything about your world is accidental, and that the random world is, quote, indifferent to your hopes as it is to your suffering and your crimes. Now, let's just follow that through. What do you say if you are a consistent naturalist to somebody who suffered appallingly? So, for example, somebody who has lost their teenage son in an accident. He was cycling down a road and a car didn't see him and swerved into him. He was killed instantly, like my mum's friend. What would you say to her? You'd have to say, unlucky. Just how the universe happened to behave today. Millions of accidents after the first accident that kicked it off. It's really all you can say. It's indifferent to your sufferings. What do you say to your crimes? I remember talking to one of the professors when I was doing my PhD, and basically I was always being kind of mocked and laughed at for being the loony religious guy by that stage at coffee time. And I'm going to tell you about the one conversation where I said something that worked, okay? I'm not going to tell you about any of the ones that I looked stupid in, because I'm doing the talk, but that was the majority, but this one time it worked out. I said to her, Kate, I don't understand why, if you're right about the universe, why killing you would be any more wrong than cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast. We did get on well, by the way, Kate and I, but just for the sake of argument. In both cases, all I'd be doing would be rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, much the same kind of thing, just increasing the entropy of the universe by a factor of 2. And she thought about it for a moment. She said, well, the difference is, if you killed me, my mum would be upset. Thought that was a good answer. But then I said to her, but Kate, what's upset? Upset is just the increase of the concentration of a particular chemical in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. We're doing neuroscience, that's what she thought about the world, about brains and about emotions. Doesn't matter, it's indifferent. And yet the Bible says that we are not accidents, and that human life is a very precious gift of a God who deliberately gave it to us. He himself gave all men life and breath and everything. And so it does matter when we suffer. And it does matter very much when we hurt each other. And I want to suggest that it doesn't make Christianity true. I mean, the world really could be that depressing. But it does make me question whether the atheist is consistently living out what they say they believe. I certainly wasn't. But finally, which one makes most sense of a relationship with God and of Jesus Christ? This is what, let me read to you again from the Bible's explanation of the world. God made all mankind in order that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. And that for me was an absolutely breathtaking thought, even an idea that there would be a God who made me, who could know me, could be known by me, who wanted a relationship with me. But at that point, science is out of its depth. It's not that science is not useful or true or powerful as a tool, but science can't tell you everything that's important about the world. In particular, science isn't very useful when it comes to personal relationships. Now, I don't know you here, I guess there's people here probably who are a couple, or you come with your partner or something. But imagine, I doubt very much that any of you entered into those relationships using and trusting only with the results that you could determine from science. You saw on your first date, you asked for a blood sample or something for doing a DNA search. I doubt that. Let me know if you did. It'd be an interesting story. But I mean, just imagine you wanted to get to know me. Maybe you don't after this talk, but imagine you did. And all you could have to go on was what you could find out from science. What could you tell? Well, you could, I guess you could do some electron microscopy on my trousers and find out if there's fibres from a dog or a cat I have at home. You could do DNA fingerprinting and compare it with some database and find out if I'm related to any known criminals, or maybe assess my propensity for dying young from some genetic disease. You could do gas chromatography under my armpits and work out what deodorant I'm wearing and whether it's effective in this high-pressure environment. But that's pretty much all you could tell. You couldn't tell my name. You couldn't tell what's important to me as a person, the things that make me laugh or the things that make me cry, who I care about. Almost nothing that's of any importance personally. Now, it's not that there's anything wrong with science. It's just science can't tell you everything. And if science is impotent to tell you about me, how much more impotent to tell you about the God who made everything? I mean, how do you go about measuring him? If he's everywhere, how do you even exclude him from the apparatus to take a null reading as a control? We'd have no hope of knowing God, except that he's taken the initiative to make himself known. And the amazing Christian claim is that God has entered the universe. The God who made it has entered it in the person of Jesus Christ in history. And Paul says in his speech to the Athenians that means we've got to change our minds, change our thinking, get straight about God. He says the times of ignorance got overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he's fixed the day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man he's appointed. And of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now, I think the interesting word of that is the word assurance, or in some translations the word proof. And that is, I think, often what we don't expect to find in the Bible. I don't know about you, but you might have bought into the kind of lie that science is all about evidence and religion is all about blind faith. That's often what's trotted out. But actually, the Bible isn't asking anyone to believe anything blindly. The Bible is very concerned about evidence and proof. It's asking us to believe in God as the creator of the world on the basis of his acts in the world in history through Jesus Christ. And in particular, his resurrection from the dead. Now, Richard Dawkins, I think this is the most disappointing thing about the book, he discusses the resurrection only once in the book. And then only to say that it must have either happened or not happened, which obviously I agree with. And then he concludes that it cannot have happened, being in the very nature of the case in contradiction with the laws of physics. I don't think that's a good way of doing science. To say before looking at the evidence, to rule it out a priori. Nothing about physics that tells you that that will always be the case. I think what he means is that the resurrection can't have happened by being in the very nature of the case a contradiction of my belief in naturalism. Because it is. If you're a naturalist, if the world is just matter and chance, then miracles cannot have happened. But if you're even open to the possibility of there being a God who ordered the world, then of course you observe the world consistently, scientifically, over generation and generation and generation. But there's absolutely nothing to stop the God who orders atoms in that way from once in history doing things differently to get our attention. In fact, if Jesus really was God on earth, that is what I would expect. Imagine if I were to tell you that actually you thought I was just a speaker for this talk, but actually I'm God, I made everything. Goodness barge. I think you would probably want some kind of evidence for that. And you would expect me to do some kinds of things that no one else can do. And of course, that's what Jesus does. He dies and he rises again. Which one makes most sense of that? Well, actually, there's only one way of making sense of that. That he must be the God who made us. That human life is in his hand as a gift from him. And he wants to know us in relationship. But now it's time to change our minds. Now, I did that back in 1994, just after writing a very bad poem. The best decision I ever made. It might be that you're just at the beginning of thinking about it all, but I'd urge you to look into the evidence, to do the scientific thing. Read one of the eyewitness documents of Jesus' life. I think there's some at the back you can take away free. And begin to ask the question, who is this? Am I even open to the possibility there's a God who made me? Or do I actually have a blind faith in atheism that will rule out all the evidence before I've even looked at it? Which I think will be very bad science. Thank you very much for listening. I'm going to hand it to Marcus. He'll explain what happens next.
Many thanks, Andrew. So now's the time for Q&A.
A lot of questions, so I've only just received, so I haven't got a chance to censor them or put them in any kind of order. So I'm just gonna go through them in the order they're in. So thank you very much for writing them down. Two questions from the first person. Why are humans so badly designed, someone says. I think this is an argument that Dawkins uses, you know, why have appendices, why have genetic mistakes and that kind of thing. I think it's a very arrogant question of yours, but an arrogant point of Dawkins's in some ways, to presume to know what would be a better way for God to make things. I think humans are very amazingly designed. I'm pretty happy with all the amazing things that our bodies are capable of. And I think it's an argument the kind of logic of it goes, if I were God making a human being, I would do it in this kind of way, and that isn't how God's done it, therefore he must be deficient. And I just think we don't know everything about why everything is as it should be. And in particular, the Bible says that humanity, and in fact the whole world, has gone wrong since the day that God made it. So God made humans perfectly to know him and to be immortal. I don't know what an immortal human being would look like biologically, but the world changed, and changed very fundamentally when we fell out of relationship with God. And we turned away from him in distrust and said, we want to live in the world that you've made, but without you, which is something that all of us do. But when that first happens, the Bible says that everything about the world order changed. And it's very hard for us to now, scientifically, all we do scientifically is observe the world now, to imagine what it would be like before anything went wrong. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's kind of brokennesses and defects that are now part of our world that weren't there in the beginning. You might think that's a cop-out question. But the Bible certainly thinks that the world has changed and isn't any more perfect. The Bible certainly doesn't think that we're in a perfect world with perfect bodies now. We're in decaying, broken, fallen bodies, which will get old and die and decay. But that wasn't God's original intention for the world. Second question by the same person, on the resurrection, is it not possible that it's simply fiction? Yes, it is. Of course it is. So you can claim all kinds of things, but all kinds of things have been claimed. All I'm asking you to do tonight is to look into the evidence for it. So, you know, I used to dismiss it with a wave of the hand and say, well, obviously, people back then were very unscientific. They didn't really understand about science, and so they believed all kinds of things. But if you think about it for a moment, you don't have to be that scientifically sophisticated as a society to know that resurrections don't happen. All you've got to do is bury a few generations of people and notice that none of them ever come back again, which they knew. And that's why when they are encountered with the resurrection of Jesus, it's an absolutely life-changing thing. They don't go, well, of course, this could easily happen because we don't understand biology. They go, this could never happen. So he must be God's king. And the people who were there to witness it were, this is one of the strongest bits of evidence in my mind, the people who were there to witness it, who would know whether it's true or not. You know, they were there to watch Jesus crucified, and they were the people who said that they'd seen him alive again. They staked their life on it. They were prepared to go to die, to be flogged and beaten, and in many cases executed. And they would not change their story. They had very little in it for fame or for riches or reputation. But it is the kind of behaviour, I think, convincingly, of people who were absolutely sure that it had happened. If they knew that Jesus had beat death and could beat death for them, then why wouldn't they die happily for defending that? So it might be fiction, but you can't decide that a priori because of blind faith in naturalism, I would suggest. I think you should look at the evidence with an open mind and ask yourself, am I even open to the possibility that there could be a God? And if there could be a God, it wouldn't be that difficult for him to raise him from the dead. And in fact, it would be exactly the kind of thing I'd expect him to do, to show me that he's not just an ordinary human being. And did it happen? Which is very different from reading it and saying, I've already decided it hasn't happened because I'm going to hold on to my atheism first. That's what I'd love for you to do. Is there any evolutionary benefit to emotions such as fear, anger, sadness, etc.? I don't think what's behind this question. I mean, some people would say yes. So evolutionary biologists would try and account for all kinds of human behaviours, including emotional behaviours. Maybe you mean by that my point about suffering not mattering and crime not mattering, you might be saying, perhaps, I don't know, I'm just reading into the question now, maybe you're saying, well, look, we've got evolutionary reasons for why you might feel sad about someone dying, and that's why it's there. Yeah, okay, fair enough. But still, it doesn't matter. It's just a trick your DNA's played on you. It's just a species survival mechanism, but there's nothing actually wrong about it. And all I'm saying is, if you're a naturalist, you know, we come of age intellectually, we realise that, you've got to admit that ultimately your life reduces to nothing. Or it reduces to the law of gravity. It's an impersonal thing. And because if you got from the law of gravity, just by chance, to a human being, you can get from a human being back down to the law of gravity. And sociology is reducible to psychology. Psychology is reducible to biology. Biology is reducible to chemistry. Chemistry is reducible to physics. Physics is reducible to the law of gravity at the beginning. That's all that there is. And anything that appears to us to matter is nothing but a conditioned evolutionary random response. So, yeah, you might be able to give an evolutionary account of why I feel sad when someone dies. But you can't say why it matters. And I think that's doesn't mean it's wrong, but it means it's a pretty unpleasant way to live. And all I want to do, if that's you, is to ask you whether you really live your life on that basis. Because I didn't. Much as I criticised the Christians, I was not living consistently with what I profess to believe myself. Someone said, do you think that religious... So I have to put the ones I've done down here. It's only two down, quite a lot to go. I should go faster. Do you think religious belief systems should be taught alongside science, that they should keep them separated in different forums? So, you know, the American debate about whether you should teach creation in schools or just evolution, that kind of thing. I think there's a difficult question. I think that science is not atheistic per se. And I don't think science should be taught atheistically in schools. So the idea that science automatically has to be done with an atheistic worldview, it just wasn't the way science was ever done at the beginning. Isaac Newton didn't do his science like that. and I don't think it needs to be done like that. So if you just want to do chemistry and chemistry lessons, that's fine. But don't do chemistry and say, of course, there's no God, because that's just like sneaking your atheism into lessons. So I don't think you should do that. And I also think that we should be free to talk about... I think that sometimes there's a kind of censorship of God things. You can talk about history, but you can't talk about the resurrection in a history lesson. Why not, though? Because it's an event of history that either happened or didn't happen. In fact, actually, the most important event of history, if it happened. So as long as we don't kind of compartmentalise religion into the kind of private hobby kind of lesson, because, of course, these questions do affect everything else in our culture. They affect our science, our geography, or everything. So, but yeah, I'm not saying that all state school teachers should be Christians, because obviously they're not. That would be unrealistic. Okay. In Genesis and Exodus, God says he made the world in 6 days. Do you believe him, or do you think he was trying to say something else as some claim? I don't really want to say what I think now, because Christians have different views, and I don't want to offend Christians here who might have different views to me. But I'll tell you the different views there are. So some Christians believe that when Genesis talks about God making the world in 6 days, he is talking about 6 24-hour periods. So it took God, I can't do the math, but whatever that is. And therefore, dating from then and the birth of Adam all the way through today, you can work out a date for the earth, which is 6,000, 8,000 years old. And they say, well, that's obviously very different from what geology, most geology tells us the world is millions of years old. Obviously, it isn't really, it's only 7,000 years old, and we got mistaken about that. Some Christians say that. I would say it's very possible for God to make the world in 6 days if he wanted to. But that would lead you in conflict with various well-assumed scientific results. Some Christians would say they got those wrong. We got science wrong. Other Christians would say that the days of Genesis are a figurative way of writing, because the Bible contains different kinds of literature. And it's not to say that we're just sweeping it under the carpet. It's just to say maybe it's not supposed to be understood literally. So I'll give you an example. There's a song in the Bible that says, the guy says, I'm poured out like water. And he doesn't mean as a miracle where he became kind of fluid state and was a pool on the floor. He means, I feel rubbish. And so in a poetic kind of way, he says, I'm poured out like water. And the question is the first book, the first chapter of the first book of the Bible, which kind of literature is it? Is it the poetry kind of literature where you use symbolism like that? Or is it the kind of facts reporting what happened in order kind of literature, where you mean 24 hours? And Christians have different views on that. Christians have different ideas. So at least I wouldn't say to you, if you're asking that as an atheist, I wouldn't say it was the kind of silver bullet argument. Because if you don't think the world was made in 6 days, a lot of Christians don't think that either. That isn't the question on which Christianity stands or falls. There'll be different views probably in this room about that. What about evolution? It seems quite a compelling theory. How do you square this with your faith? I haven't said anything about evolution in this talk, kind of deliberately, because I think this can be the thing that generates lots and lots of hot air and you never get past it. So well done for sneaking it in with only 4 questions left. Again, Christians have different views on it. So some Christians would say that God uses evolution as a process by which he creates. So Christians would disagree with evolution purely by chance, because we believe that God ordered and designed the world. And they would say that God used evolution that way. Other Christians would say that as a theory, we've got too ambitious about it, because we observe evolution in terms of bacteria adapting to different situations, kind of antibacterial resistance, that kind of thing. And we observe variants within a species to adapt their environment, like Darwin observed with moth patterning and camouflaging and lengths of beaks on finches. But that's a far cry from saying that we've proved that this is the mechanism by which we got from a fish to a human being. And actually, the evidence for that is light and thin. And people have leapt on it because they wanted a non-God explanation for it. So Christians have different views about that. But again, I don't think that evolution is the deciding question. There's Christians on both sides of it. I think that is a question. I think the deciding question is, Is there a God who made this world? Or is this world a random accident? And that is the question to answer. Does evolution, I'll just say this about it, does evolution explain the gap between a Big Bang and the appearance of a human being? I think that's problematic in all kinds of ways. As the idea that evolution is all that you need to explain everything that we see, I think that has problems. I mean, to start with, you can't even get evolution started without at least RNA, which is one of the most complicated molecules that exists. So you've got to have a lot of RNA, and then all kinds of copying mechanisms and that kind of thing, before you can even start the process. I think that has some problems, but people have different views on that. These questions are getting harder, as it turns out. If CERN discovers the God particle, what positions does that put Christians in? I think it would show us a little bit more about the world that God had made. You know, we're just understanding a bit more about physics, which God designed and ordered, make physicists very happy. It would justify the enormous budget of CERN, and it wouldn't make a lot of difference to the questions of this evening, I don't think. We just understand a bit more. Understanding the what of the world doesn't tell you why it's here to start with at all, and the who of who put it together. Very nervously on this trajectory of harder questions. I'm very nervous to read this one. Our solar system is a tiny speck in our universe, and there are many different galaxies out there which may have some life form similar to us. In the Bible it says Jesus came down on this earth to save us. Is Jesus' sacrifice still applicable throughout the whole universe if there are other life forms in other galaxies? Wow. Okay. I don't even know how to answer that. I think in the Bible, it's clear that human beings are very important to God. And that isn't something you'd necessarily work out just from cosmology. You know, there are millions of solar systems, millions and millions of planets, maybe other life forms. Why should this one be so important? You know, why should God care? If God is on the scale of the whole cosmos, why should he bother so much about this species here on this planet? And actually, the Bible wonders at that as well. I'll just read to you. One of the songs in the Old Testament has exactly that same kind of thought. It's Psalm 8 in the Old Testament. And the author says, O Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And he says, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? Right, look at the scale of, and at that stage, maybe he doesn't even know about the size of the Milky Way. He just knows about some stars and the moon. But even looking at that much, we're tiny, why do you care? But it is clear in the Bible, amazing, that God does care. And that he has made us deliberately in order to know him. And that's why the Bible describes God's amazing dealings in history with this species. That he cared enough about our relationship with him for which we were made to come in person onto this planet to save us. And that God would come and for our forgiveness sake send his son to die on a cross to bear the punishment that we deserved. I don't think you can explain why that should be so important to God to do, except that he decided when he made the world that mankind, humankind, should be made to be in relationship with him. And when we fell out of relationship with him, pushing God out of the world, saying, I'm going to ignore you, as many of us here this evening have done, myself included, God cared enough about that situation to want to reconcile us to him. Now, did God care similarly about an alien in Alpha Centauri? And I have no idea. But he does care that much about us. And I guess that's the question of most relevance to us. Last question. Oh, good, I've already answered this one. How do you reconcile your Christian beliefs with the theory of evolution? We kind of talked about that. Any questions from the floor? Or any replies to questions I've answered badly or inadequately or comebacks? Yeah, thank you. I think that is helpful. I talk about this book in a minute, but a guy called John Lennox describes the analogy of a cake that his Aunt Matilda made, and it's a rather delicious cake and everyone enjoys it. And he gets a scientist in and he says, tell me about this cake, and they get very excited and they do all this chemical analysis and they tell you how much protein is in it and all that kind of thing. And then he said, the twinkling in his eye, oh yes, but why did Aunt Matilda make this cake? And the scientists are totally stumped, and he goes off smiling, and actually it's for her birthday or whatever. And some people say, look, science can tell you about the universe, it can describe what's here, but it can't say why is it here. It can tell you about human beings, how do we function, but not what's our life for. I think that is helpful as far as it goes. But my one caution with it is I wouldn't want to parcel the world out into, and some people have tried this. This is what the philosopher Immanuel Kant did. He divided the world into the kind of stuff that is physical and testable and science deals with, and then the kind of floaty stuff about emotions and beliefs and morals which religion deals with. And I wouldn't want to do quite that. I know you're not saying this, but I wouldn't want to do quite that, because the Bible is dealing with some of the what's as well. So there are places where the Bible's view of the world actually makes a difference to what happened with science. So what happened to Jesus' body after he died? What happened to his life biologically 3 days later? And so Jesus' intervention in history means that God got involved with the physical world. So it wasn't just physical is science, spiritual is religion. Jesus got involved with the physical world and changed the physical world in all kinds of amazing ways as a proof that he was the creator of the physical world. So very helpful thing to say, what about the why question? But religion does more than just talk about what we feel like, how we should live. It also deals with why are atoms here? Who is the God who designed these atoms? What happened in history when Jesus came? Any final question? Yeah. I still think you need to know something to compare it against. So you have to, it starts with the assumption that God wants to give us the most brilliant eye that we could possibly have. They didn't do that because it would be better if we had a different kind of eye, and so he made a mistake. But how do we know what kind of eye God wanted humans being to have? I mean, he gives an eye that can see things and can read things and can enjoy a relationship with each other, and it's pretty good for the job. So how do we know that God was wanting to do something in a way that we think is more optimal? I'm just not sure we know that about it, against which to measure whether he's done the right kind of job. So I think it seems to me an argument that second guesses what God's intention should be and then tells him whether he's achieved them. But I don't think we know at that kind of level about how God wanted eyes to be, or whether he wanted me to be able to fly and I can't, and so he's failed, or whatever. Can I say one last thing? It's like cheeky because I'm at the front. But my plea to you going away from today would be, I haven't given you a talk to persuade you to be a Christian. I haven't given you that kind of evidence to you. I hope I've given you a talk that resists the easy dismissal of Christianity, which many in our society encourage us to do. You just write it off, it's unscientific, I don't have to bother with looking at it. What I would love you to do as you go away is take the trouble to look into it. Because these things really matter. If we live in this world as people created and designed by God, who wants to know us and has come into history to reveal himself to us and has commanded us to change our minds about him, that really matters. And if this world, if this is all delusion and actually the world is just random and here it is, then that matters as well, because people like myself and your friend, maybe he brought you, are wasting our lives. But it matters enough to look at the evidence. And all I'd love you to do would be actually to look at that for yourself. I'd never done that in my life. It won't take you that long. To look at some of the eyewitness for Jesus Christ and say, what if it is? Is it even possible that this is the case, that this is what happened, or not? And that would be, I think, a great step forward and something I'd love you to do. Thank you, Marcus.